This episode is brought to you in part by Zondervan, publisher of Ghosted, An American Story, written and narrated by New York Times bestselling ghostwriter Nancy French, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter at Burns23, follow at your own risk. And joining me, as always, is the president of The Witness, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Jamar Tisby. What's going on, brother?
Hey, man, I'm trying to figure it all out, man. I don't even know. My head's in like 15 different places right now is wild.
You know, what's crazy is I was thinking about that too. And then we had this like short conversation, like, yo, what do we even say when people are asking us how we're doing? Like, how does that even play itself out? Because I, you know, sometimes I think people don't actually want to know how I'm doing.
You know,
so it's like, yo, I'm good, man. I'm okay. But then also thing, yeah. I don't want to lie, you know, and I don't want to be like overly churchy, be like, I'm blessed and highly favored, because number one, that might be different connotations for other people. It's a lot, man. How do you answer these basic human questions? It's crazy out here.
It's very tough. And this week was exceptional because as we're recording this, it's right after Thanksgiving. And so like I'm filled up with family and friends. We got to go back to the Chicago area where I grew up. I got to see my family. I got to see some extended family I haven't seen for 16 years, man. 16 years.
Wow.
I couldn't even believe it. And I got to see some friends I grew up with. So I'm like, you know, filled up with just good things and remembering where you came from and all the love, all the immaturity and tensions you have to grow out of, all that too. But then also sort of paying attention to the headlines and so much is happening in the world that's negative. And it's like, on one hand, extremely local and personal. And on the other hand, you know, sort of this national and international scope that has you burdened for stuff that's way beyond you. So it's hard. I think we have to really remember we're mind, body, soul, and sort of spend time getting in touch with where we are. Because if we don't, there's just a cascade of information and input that I think threatens to drown us. So that's just
I think that's actually the subtext of everything we've been doing for the past 2 to 3 years, is trying to figure out like what's a space that's emotionally, physically, spiritually, mentally healthy for us. Black men in America who are constantly inundated with these hashtags. I mean, there was a hashtag EJ Bradford that just happened. It was about 45 minutes away from where my wife and I were. Actually on Christmas, not Christmas, on Thanksgiving evening. And so shopping Black Friday and doing all that with the fam. And so, you know, you just think about how those are situations that hit so close to home. And then you're trying to figure out like, what's this space for us to just be honest and, you know, about how we're doing. And is there a space for that? Is there, you know, is that something that our churches even have the bandwidth for? You know, that's tough. That's tough. But I did want to ask you, man, did politics come up at all in the conversation?
Did
it ever come up in the conversation around the Thanksgiving dinner table?
No. And it's interesting. So I see like every Thanksgiving, every holiday season rolls around and you see all these articles about how to talk to your family about politics and Thanksgiving or how to avoid those topics. I'm like, is it the same for like Black people? Because if you look at the statistics, we're actually the most reliably partisan demographic in the nation, meaning we tend to vote all for the same party. I think that does cover up a lot of ideological diversity. And so it wasn't at the Thanksgiving meal, but we did get into it a little bit about conservatism versus liberal, but it wasn't heated or anything like that. What about you?
Right. Yeah, no, it was never, I've never really had Thanksgiving dinner table politic conversation. Now, there have been times where it's like, kind of the after when everybody's kind of rolling around and, you know, some comes across a ticker on the news or someone's flipping the channels and they're like, oh, here she go again. You know, you'll get little comments like that. But I didn't necessarily have no knockdown, drag out, you know, thought process or, you know, debate or controversy. I personally don't I'm not really familiar with that. Like that happened maybe once with my aunt when I was like super conservative, where I was like Fox News to the, yeah, to the truth. Yeah. Like that one year where I was just so colonized. I was like, don't vote for Obama. Never vote for him ever because of these 10 reasons, you know, like vociferously like arguing against a candidate when I had never done that before, which was odd, you know? And my aunt was like, yo, you okay? Like, why are you thinking like this? Anyway, and so now she kind of laughs because she's like, well, okay, see, I converted you now. So it's always funny to talk to her because she's the oldest sibling on my dad's side. And so whenever I get the opportunity to talk with her, whenever she stops by, I'm able to go to Mississippi. We always laugh about that one conversation because the whole family was just like sitting there watching us go back and forth. And they were like, yo, you should like run for some sort of political office. And I'm like, nah, man, because of this, this, and this. And now I'm like, bro, I didn't even know what I was talking about.
Wow.
Just putting words together, man. So I don't know. At the Thanksgiving dinner table itself, I'm not familiar with that. But kind of in the after time where we're just kind of resting and chilling. Yeah, sometimes. But as you said, like, it's not a lot we disagree on.
Right.
In those settings. So it's kind of like the stakes are different when you're amongst your own.
Well, that's the whole thing, right? It's like, I think people insultingly say that the Black community in America has been duped by, in, you know, the last 60 years or so, the Democratic Party.
Yeah, like we have to like unpack the implications, the subtext of that. Like, we don't have the capacity to think intelligently on our own. And so we've just unwittingly bought a lie. You know, we've fallen into a trap because we just don't have the intellectual cognitive nuance to see like, oh, this candidate might not be all good. You know, like this is a weird. But they often, I hate when people say that.
Yay, come on, all the Black people. Y'all vote. We got watermelons over here. Like, is that what you think? That's what it feels like. Like, how can you say that for the past, you know, however many decades, millions of Black people to a woman, to a man, have just been hoodwinked and bamboozled by the Democratic Party. Now, this is not at all saying the Democrats have done an awesome job.
Come on, y'all. Like, man, see, we shouldn't even have to say that. We should not have to say that. I know y'all want us to say that and y'all want us to have all these qualifiers. We shouldn't have to qualify ourselves when we didn't say what you think we said. We didn't say that. Here's the funny thing. The funny thing I've always thought about that is even Black conservatives, whether you're Black conservatives or Black liberals, even Black conservatives use language of liberation.
What?
Like, so they're like, listen to this, because this is funny. They're like, oh, well, you're enslaved to the Democratic Party. You need to break free from the I'm like, wait a minute. So you agree with liberation. Like, so it's like, okay, well, this is not a concept when it comes to racism, but then it's a concept when it comes to what? Like, how does this work? Like, anyway, I could go on and on about that. Yeah. But I think we're on 10 because of the midterms that just happened.
Exactly.
And I'm going to be honest with you. I'm a political junkie, so I like to go through all the little, you know, look at the counties and the things. Yep. Like, it's so funny how people were talking about the tightness of the Florida governor's race where I live. And I sat back and I laughed because I'm like, the Florida governor's race the past two elections has been decided by one percentage point. Like, this is normal. Yeah. That's just Florida being Florida.
Yeah.
Like, we're an extremely divided state because there's a northern part of the state and then there's a southern part of the state. And the southern part of the state is typically more diverse. And the northern part of the state and in a lot of places in the central part of the state, it's more conservative and it's kind of, you know, homogenous as far as a demographic. And so, you know, I just like doing all that stuff. And it's bad because, you know, you kind of get invested in it. You're like, oh, man, what's going to happen? Is this going to happen? And it's not like sports, but it's covered like sports.
Yeah.
So he's going to shoot a three. Like, nobody can do anything at that point. Like, it's over. But it's covered in a way that's like, man, well, what will happen if this county is like, they're only 65% in and he's got a huge advantage. And I don't know. It's always very interesting. And so the theater of it, I really enjoy. But I think as I've grown older, I kind of come to this realization that the stakes are high for a lot of people. So this determines for a lot of people, you know, their wage, or determines whether or not, and it did for me in a previous election, whether or not I get healthcare, you know? So I was like, oh, okay. Like, I should probably get healthcare. Like, that would be awesome. And it's like, well, they won't cover me without like exorbitant rates because of pre-existing conditions. And so I was like, oh, so this is actually a thing. And so I'm like, dang, like I should probably get involved in this political process to see what's going on. So
it actually matters. Yes.
Yeah. So we had all these races in my area and in my state. And then now you have another race that's actually going on right now in your, the state where you kind of reside ish, yeah. in Mississippi, a state that's really close to you and a state where you spend a whole bunch of time. So man, what is going on in this? Whoa. It's a Senate race, right?
Yes, it's a Senate
race. What's going on in this Mississippi Senate race, man? Y'all right. joking about lynchings. Y'all got people talking about crazy stuff. Is this funny to y'all now? Like, is this a thing?
It's always been like this. So it goes back to the point we were making earlier about Black people being sort of the most solidly Democrat voting group demographic in the nation. But there's a reason for that, like a very simple reason. And it has to do with racism. We vote for the candidate and the party that is less overtly racist. Notice my words, less overtly racist. Now, in the Mississippi Senate race, there was a senator who got sick earlier this year. And the governor, Phil Bryant, who's a staunch Republican and a Trump supporter, he appointed a woman named Cindy Hyde-Smith, who is, of course, a staunch Republican and not just a Trump supporter. She has voted with him 100% of the time, 100% of the mm-hmm. time. Now, she is in a runoff with a Democratic senator. And this is very interesting. His name is Mike Espy. Not only is he Democratic, but he's Black. If Espy gets elected, he would be the first Black U.S. senator from Mississippi since Reconstruction.
We still doing first, y'all. We still doing first in 2018.
You can wrap your head around that. Reconstruction was from roughly 1865 to 1867. We had Hiram Revels in there. We have one more, and that's it for Black senators, male or female, from the state of Mississippi up through 2018. Can you imagine that? This is more than 115 years, 120 years, and no Black representation in the Senate. So you have not only a Democrat against a Republican, you have white against Black. And not only do you have white against Black, you have Cindy Hyde-Smith, who is recorded on video saying of a supporter, if he invited me to a public hanging, I would sit in the front row. This is in a state with the most recorded lynchings, right? Like there were a lot of public
hangings. Yeah, that's just a weird comment. Like, so the reason I'm hopping in is because we had a situation like this in a Florida governor's race with Ron DeSantis, who's a former congressman,
yeah.
running for governor against Andrew Gillum, who is a Black mayor of Tallahassee. And the day after Gillum won, kind of out of nowhere, Ron DeSantis says something in the frame of, well, we don't need to monkey this up. We don't need to monkey yeah. it up. And I'm like, my man, like, who talks like that? And people, it's so funny because you will always find people, there is no unimpeachable right and wrong in our political news cycle. Someone will say, well, you know, this is what happened that caused this, or you know what he meant. And it's on all sides. And it's just hilarious to me because I'm like, who talks like that? I mean, was right. he saying monkey around? Like, and why would you say monkey? Like, who thinks of this? Like, who thinks of, man, if he was holding a public hanging, I would be there with a like shirt on. It's like, what? Like, how does this even work itself out?
So in a biblical frame, like every time, and this is true for me, and boy, am I terrified because I say so much, but out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks.
Bruh, come on.
So bring to that Bible me, in. These are not just like careless comments that they pulled out of the air. This is in their sort of atmosphere, right? And this is what has seeped into their framework and their worldview, their way of thinking about life, that in spontaneous comments tell the truth because you don't have time to plan and gauge reactions. You just speak out of your heart, right? So in this moment of spontaneous commentary, she said, if he invited me to a public hanging, I would be in the front row. Okay, so number one, if somebody invites me to a public hanging, I'm calling authorities. I'm protesting. I'm not going to let this happen. I'm rescuing the victim. And then you want to go on to say, you're going to be in the front row?
What? Yeah, like what's the joke there? Like, why is that funny? Like, I don't. Was it as related to like, hey, I'm really committed to this particular donor, or like, was that what she was trying to say? I'm lost here.
Here's what's frustrating is that okay, so she gives this very tepid non-apology, right? And doesn't admit. She says he was just joking around. People are twisting it. She's not racist. And it's just like it's pulling out my hair because I'm like, you don't say that comment unless you are raised in a white homogenous bubble and you don't even think about the impact this would have on Black people, which, by the way, Mississippi has the highest percentage of Black people of any state. DC is higher, but of any state in the union. So close to 40%.
That's weird. No Black senator since Reconstruction.
Exactly. And this is not.
Man, that's weird, bro.
Wherever you have a high percentage of Black people, it could be in a city, it could be in a state, it could be in a county, you have some of the most ardent attempts to preserve white supremacy. And Mississippi is case in point. Man, this rabbit hole is deep, bro.
Yeah, it's crazy. So apparently something happened where the governor chimed in. Oh, and this is where it got interesting. So it was very interesting. I was like, oh, okay. And one of our friends, Reverend C.J. Rhodes, he talks about this actually in an article on The Witness, BCC.com. So if you want to check it out, it's Why the History of Lynching is No Laughing Matter. And so this is amazing, man. He mentioned that, you know, the governor immediately goes to, and this is right at the National Right to Life President's endorsement. Like, the governor immediately goes to, well, we got Black genocide and it's 20 million African-American children that have been aborted and no one wants to say anything about that. First of all, whenever you say no one wants to say anything about that, I always sit back. I'm like, yeah, I've stopped saying that myself because I'm like, yeah, probably a lot of people talk about that.
Uh-huh.
And it's true. Like, Black conservatives talk about that all the time. Right to life organizations and anti-abortion organizations, pro-life organizations, they talk about this statistic all the time, or these similar statistics. Now, how they present these statistics are always very interesting to me. And, you know, we can parse into that in another podcast or now, either one. But so the governor chimes in and he just kind of digs a hole a little bit deeper, right?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So he chimes in. He's like, nobody's talking about the 20 million aborted babies, which I don't know where he gets that number. But it's always astounding to me that someone who demonstrates.
No, he said, according to Wikipedia.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Like he said, no, that's literally what he said. He said, according to Wikipedia, like you have to Google Black stats, like Black stats on abortion.
And it's always astounding to me how people who in their policies show absolutely no concern for Black people who in Mississippi are the poorest of the poor. Then you want to trot out a concern for Black babies in the womb, where you're not paying attention to the mortality rate of Black mothers when they're giving birth. You're not paying attention to the poor health care that these mothers are getting. You're not paying attention to the incarceration rates of brothers and uncles and fathers in the family that could help.
And women, Black women are the highest as far as the expanding incarceration rates. Black women in prison, they're growing the most, more than any other demographic. Like Dominique Gilliard in his book, Rethinking Incarceration, has phenomenal work on this. That sometimes we talk about prisons and incarceration as separating children from Black fathers. But he said now we need to talk about it as separating children from Black mothers because it's just such an epidemic and it's such an increase that we're not talking about. Anyway,
Sorry. You're absolutely right. So speak to those issues on a consistent basis, and you might have some credibility when you bring up Black babies in the womb. Otherwise, miss me with that. It's a deflection. So none of this takes away or does anything to explain or walk back Hyde Smith's comments. And not only did she say that, she was also recorded in another video joking, saying, let's make it a little bit harder for these liberal college students to vote, which is the actual definition of voter suppression. Your opponents, they disagree with you and you want to make it more difficult for them to vote, which, by the way, there's a very long history of in the United States in general, in the South in particular, in Mississippi specifically. So again, no laughing matter, particularly given the history. And not only that, there's one more at least. Actually, there's a whole expose that the Jackson Free Press did. Shout out to the JFP for doing some wonderful research and work on all of this, but particularly Hyde Smith's background. But there was another photo that surfaced of her in 2014 at the Jefferson Davis, quote, presidential library. Jefferson Davis, of course, was the president of the Confederacy.
Yo, I didn't see this. Oh, I'm interested in this. I didn't see this.
Oh, bruh. I mean, telling you, the rabbit hole is deep. So she's holding a Civil War era rifle. She has a caption that says, you know, like something like the best, you know, the best Mississippi history, you know, Mississippi history as told in all its truth, something like that. Right. And she's standing next to someone from the Sons of Confederate Veterans. He might have even been the president. Shout out to Bo York, our producer. He has produced an incredibly informative podcast
which y'all
called
should
Red
subscribe
Flag.
To right now. Like, look, go to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe to it.
It's some of his best work. It's so well produced. The storytelling is rich and informative, and he quotes the guy who is pictured in the photo with Cindy Hyde Smith. And the man is basically making the point where, yeah, I know black people were brought here as slaves, but that's part of your heritage and you should be proud of it.
What?
I'm like,
hold up, man. What? Yo, part of me is not even surprised anymore when I hear these comments, but I did not know about that comment. That's crazy, man.
I promise you. I'm going to get the exact quote for you. It's a man named Greg Stewart of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. He's a spokesman for them. And he said on the podcast, if you're a black Mississippian, you can pretty much bet that you got here because your ancestors came here as slaves. That's not, first of all, you weren't the slave and aren't any slave masters left. But the other point is you got here somehow. And instead of being ashamed of it or being mad about it, there's really a lot of pride in that.
Boy, what?
That's verbatim. You can look, it's episode 6 entitled 2001 on Red Flag Pod. Quote me.
Wow. Bro, I'm blown away.
Him.
I'm blown away. I did not know about that quote. That is, wow, you dropping this on the pod, so I'm getting like a raw reaction of things I want to say, but I'm not going to say because the Lord working on me yet through his Holy Spirit.
This is rattling around in my brain, you know, all week. And, you know, it's Thanksgiving. You're supposed to be thankful and all this. And meanwhile, we've got a runoff election with somebody. So here's the thing. How would you parse this, Tyler? Is Cindy Hyde Smith, given her comments, given her background, is she racist?
I mean, what does it matter? Like, I don't even really care. Like, yeah, in you know, a natural, if we have to go in and do some scientific evidence on it, like, yo, if we compare the comments, but nobody talks about the spectrum that qualifies you as officially racist. Like, is it one comment? Is it two comments? Is the N-word? Is it hanging around Confederate people? Is it this? Is it that? Is it joking about a public hanging? Is it? I'm like, man, I don't even. What does it matter? Like, the reality of the matter is she has no thought for the comments that she makes as it relates to people of color. And so that should alarm people. Whether or not she's classified as a racist by a strict definition is inconsequential. It's intent versus impact, because it seems as though we have to prove the blackest of the heart intentions for someone to be qualified as racist. And I say, man, throw it away. If y'all don't want to call people racist, don't call people racist. But we have to deal with the comments that they make. And clearly they're insensitive, and clearly they're ill-informed, and clearly they're harmful. So whether or not you want to call it a word, that's why I'm not even going to give people power to say, like, oh man, well, he called her this and they called him this. It doesn't matter about whether or not they fit in the technical definition. It doesn't matter whether or not you have a criteria that I would disagree with, or I have a criteria that you would disagree with. These comments are reckless. So now what are we going to do with that? Call her whatever you want to call her. But what I'm saying is, how are we going to deal with these comments? And that's the whole thing with Trump and everything else. I think people spend a whole bunch of time arguing about whether or not someone should be classified in a way without dealing with the substance of what's going on. Mm. And I understand from a media perspective, there's power in naming things. So there's power in naming it. But what I found is people are reflexively opposed to entering into a conversation in any way, shape, or form when that word is used. Oh, well, throw the word away. You still gonna have to deal with everything.
That's good. That's good.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Nine Lives and Counting, A Bounty Hunter's Journey to Faith, Hope, and Redemption, written by Dwayne Dog the Bounty Hunter Chapman. Nine Lives and Counting not only offers a fresh perspective on well-known life events, but also ventures into behind-the-scenes territory and backstories never shared publicly. Nine Lives and Counting is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. Visit thomasnelson.com/audio to learn more.
I read an op-ed, again, from the Jackson Free Press by a guy named Fred Rand, who grew up in a very similar way as Cindy Hyde Smith. Now, one of the things that came out through this investigative reporting is that she went to a white segregation academy. And there's a whole lot to unpack there. What blew me away was the amount of people responding on social media who were surprised that there were such things as white segregation academies, or that they were so common. All over the country.
Not just in the South, like everywhere. Like, come on, y'all. Like, if we talk about Congress in and of itself, we want to walk through Congress. I mean, come on, man. You're going to find a lot of things that surprise you.
So she went to this white segregation academy and had this whole history, like their mascot is Colonel Reb from the you know, the rebels, the Civil War.
Wow.
You know, they're waving Confederate flags. I mean, it's deep, deep, deep. Like, this is again, I don't want to particularize it just to the South, but it's some of these things that are very celebrated nationwide in a lot of ways about this myth of the lost cause and the Confederacy. But anyway, there was an op-ed in the Jackson Free Press by a guy named Fred Rand, who came from a very similar background. He had an awakening, if you will, and realized his sort of culture of white privilege that he had grown up in. And because it was such a closed system, a social system, he had no idea that he was so privileged. But then he got out of it and started to realize. So he's writing about Cindy Hyde Smith. And I think this is going to be helpful for some people who maybe this conversation is new for. He said, "I don't think she is racist in the white nationalist sense of the word. In a way, she is something worse. She is oblivious to the real life issues of the average Mississippian and unrepentant in her ignorance."
Hmm. That's good, bro. That's poignant.
Yeah. Yeah. She's oblivious and she's unrepentant in her ignorance. She comes from a world, I'm telling you, a world that is filled with whiteness, and black people and other people of color are only peripheral. And so people can say, "Oh, you're making a lot of assumptions, X, Y, Z." No, 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 no. I've seen this. I've been adjacent to it. I go to school with folks like this. I go to church with folks like this. Here's how it goes. You're born into an all-white family. You go to an all-white preschool. You go to an all-white elementary and junior high. Maybe it's even a church school. And yeah, you got, you know, your five Asians and your one black person. So you can say you have diversity, you're not breaking the law, but really the hegemony is whiteness. You go to a high school that's maybe a private high school, or it's certainly in the affluent suburbs where there are very few minorities who tend to be more economically poor. And then you go to college. Most elite colleges and universities are predominantly white. Certainly, if you go in the state of Mississippi, the University of Mississippi is predominantly white. And not only that, it's been a bastion of preserving whiteness. And then you come back to a world of eliteness where you're a lawyer or a professional of some sense, and most of your peers remain white, and you marry white, and you have white kids, and you send them to white schools, and on and on and on it goes. And when in that cycle would you ever get interrupted to learn that black people live in a world that's almost completely different from yours? And that's Cindy Hyde Smith. And that is who Mississippians are going to vote to represent a state that is almost 40% black. And I'm like, no, no, non-starter. You can't do that. And here's the thing. I'm not asking Republicans to be Democrats. That's not the point. The point is, you cannot, particularly as a Christian, stand up and say you support a candidate who has so blatantly demonstrated a disregard and an ignorance of racial issues to the harm and detriment of black people. Okay, so look, no, you can do that. But if you do that, don't say you're for racial reconciliation. Don't say you're for diversity. don't say you're for racial progress. You can, again, I'm not saying don't be Republican. I'm just saying get a candidate who's at least better at hiding their racism or their racial ignorance. Better yet, get a candidate whose policies you agree with, but also respects the human dignity of Black people and other people of color. Like, yeah. Can we do that?
Yeah, so I think that's the very base level request. Like, if there is a possibility that people are misconstruing what we're saying, it's not that you would think like we think, but the reality of the matter is, can you maintain your core convictions politically and some of the issues that you feel very strongly about politically that, you know, you may feel are expressions of theology or you may feel affect your local community or are just personal things that you feel that America should be doing. Okay, fine. Do you, whatever. I mean, that's people who are white, that's people who are Black, there's people of all ethnicities. I get it. But the question is, can you kind of have those core convictions and at the same time not have racial insensitivity / bigotry / xenophobia / overt racism? Is that possible? And one of the difficult things for me as we talk about the voting booth is how people sometimes kind of reduce and flatten out the complexity of voting for one candidate or voting for one party over another. And the thing that's difficult is people will say, man, well, I'm just going to evaluate people based upon, you know, their merits. And I'm not going to just vote against, you know, the presidential administration. I'm not just going to vote against one party. I'm not going to do that. And I say, okay, cool. I totally understand that. But see, when I looked up the convictions and the stances and the core values for all the candidates that I voted for, that I voted in elections that included, all of the Republican candidates said they backed Trump and said they supported him. So I'm like, okay, well, listen, I get it. They might have different stances and they might have different things that won't be affected by the presidential administration, but it was their choice to tie their candidacy to him. So I'm like, now what do I do? Because I can't just sit here and ignore that they're tying their entire candidacy to him. Like, do you want me to look the other way? So in a sense, when people like judge people by their own merits, judge them by, I'm like, yeah, sure, I get you. But at the same time, why are they choosing to tether themselves to a national platform, which we would say in the most charitable sense has been comfortable with cruelty? In the most charitable way we can say it, has been comfortable with being extremely cruel to people who are marginalized. So what am I supposed to do with that? And I think that's the question is, how are we thinking through the implications of xenophobia, bigotry, racism as it relates to our political process? Because what I think is happening is a slow desensitizing on certain sides of the political aisle with those negative and, you know, I'll just say it, deplorable thought processes. And if you don't think they're deplorable, I don't know what to tell you. But the reality of the matter is, I think it's a desensitization that's happening right now, especially amongst Christians, because we're digging our heels in rather than taking an introspective look and saying, hey, if you expose my ignorance, that's a grace to me. That's a gift to me, because now I can take a step back and I can examine what you're saying. And maybe I find out I was wrong all along. Maybe I find out a blind spot that I wasn't aware of. But it can't happen if we're not open to that.
It takes a great deal of humility, is what I hear you're saying, because we have to have the humility to be corrected, even in our very strongly held beliefs and opinions. And make no mistake, for people across the political spectrum, politics has replaced religion as something they worship. And so we have to actually pay attention to the way that politics in general has become idolatrous among many Christians. But that is also not to take away from the fact that the stakes are high in politics. So for me, somebody who has lived in Mississippi, somebody who goes to school at the University of Mississippi, somebody who cares a great deal about politics and how policy affects whom Jesus would call the least of these, the poor, the marginalized, the prisoner, the stakes are extremely high. And for someone like this, in Ron DeSantis in Florida, Cindy Hyde Smith in Mississippi, the president, to speak racially insensitive, ignorant, and straight up racist comments and then be unrepentant about it deflect and change the topic and try to turn around the accusation, to me, communicates some very real and present danger. At the very least, policies that would affect people like me or who look like me, or it emboldens people who could turn violent, right? And so what really gets me is our brothers and sisters in Christ, again, stick to your principles, be a conservative, be an independent, be a Republican, whatever it might be, but don't be okay with racism from your candidates. There are plenty.
That's not binding people's conscience to say that. Like, I'm not binding your conscience to say don't be comfortable with that.
Right. Like, to me, what if you do that, like if these candidates go up and you say nothing, you don't talk to your party, you don't call, you know, elected officials, you don't, you know, protest this somehow, what it says to me at the very least is that you are ignorant and unaware of the actual history of racism in this country. I hope that it is true for many people that if they knew the real history, the names, the dates, the places, the events, that they would actually be moved and more sensitive and perhaps act more urgently in the present, right? That's actually what the hope is for the color of compromise.
Right. And I hear you, and that would be my hope too. But the reality of the matter is I'm not so sure that's enough. And one of the big questions that I've asked myself is, at least on a very base level, is there any way that you can get the attention of people who may support certain candidates to at least get them to press back against the candidate themselves and, you know, against their platform if it includes these things? Listen, you support who you support. I don't want to bind your conscience about who you should and shouldn't vote for. I have strong feelings about that, especially people who are doing things that would put people's lives in danger. I get it. But at the same time, like, hey, is there a way that you can, what would it take? And what I'm finding is it's not enough. Like, the things that we're talking about, the way that we're presenting it, it's not enough, because I truly believe it's a posture that relates to some sort of political culture war that people have just accepted. Like, it's no relinquishing of it. People have accepted it. And I feel like over the past few years, it's actually become more entrenched. And so, listen, I'm not saying people can't change, but at the same time, I'm saying, look, I don't think it's just going to be facts and figures. I think it's going to require something in our discipleship that challenges the heart of the matter and challenges our complicity. And if we don't talk about complicity, and if we don't talk about those things, as far as the way in which we are connected to the past and connected to the present and connected to what's going to be set in motion for the future, then there's no way you can write all the books in the world, Jamar. This is why it is not just simply a book reading list. It's not just simply, hey, get the black guy and get the black woman to come in and talk about race. It's not just that. It's more than that. It's at the core of our discipleship. It's at the core of how we present the gospel itself. It's at the core of what we critique as far as our Americana, as far as our history, as far as our community. It's at the core of everything we believe. And so the question is, are we going to change that? Because that's truly where the true awakening comes from. Not just from facts and figures, not just throwing out something like it's people think this is about debating and going back and forth. Well, let's get on the phone and let's debate. It's not about that, because we can debate till we're blue in the face. But the reality is, if we're not willing to take a hard look at the ignorance that we all possess, then we're going to remain entrenched. So, look, it's the hope. I don't think it's. I understand, I mean, that messes with the historian's mind. I understand. No, I get it. Because the historian is saying, come on. But the pastor in me is saying, listen, man, people going to have these idols. And to quote Calvin, the hearts are idol making factories. And I believe that. And, you know, a nod to my reform folks, I believe it. So I'm just saying, I don't know if it's just going to be facts and figures, Jamar.
I mean, look, you're talking to a guy who goes coast to coast talking to white Christians about racism. And in the last year or so, in various venues, here's what I've said. I said, I'm convinced, like, people ask me, well, what do we do about how do we change minds? And particularly the how do you change minds part. And I said, I'm convinced that you can stack facts and figures up to the ceiling. You can marshal the most airtight case you want, but it's not going to make a difference because at the end of the day, this is a spiritual issue. It is a spiritual blindness. It is a hard-heartedness that Jesus Christ himself has to remove a heart of stone and give people hearts of flesh. I'm also convinced that in certain cases, for people who won't change their minds, for people who cling so tightly to a particular narrative that pushes Black pain to the side, minimizes it, or denies it outright, that it's actually maybe a question of salvation. Now, I don't get to make that call. I am saying that you know a tree by its fruit. And if the fruit is continued indifference to one's neighbor, particularly one's Black neighbor, given the history of this country, at a certain point, you got to ask, well, what gospel have they believed? Or have they believed the gospel? So in that sense, it's far, far, far beyond an intellectual issue. It's far, far, far beyond reading books. Now, my framework is the ARC model, acronym, Awareness, Relationships, Commitment. So awareness, which is information, is part of the story, but it's not the whole story. I do think, as a student of history, there's a woeful lack of basic knowledge about U.S. history in general, let alone racial history. I mean, if you want to start somewhere, just start with the civil rights movement, because if all you know is Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and 1955 in the bus boycott and 1963 in the I Have a Dream speech, then even one of the most sort of historically analyzed, even overanalyzed periods in history, you're weak on it. So there's a lot we can do to inform ourselves, but that's not all. We have to have relationships with people who are different. Now, that's typically where a lot of folks, particularly white evangelicals, like to stop. Hey, let's go grab coffee. Let's get a lunch, or let's have them over for dinner. Actually, all those things are good, but they're necessary, but they're not sufficient. Then you also have to have commitment. You have to think more in turn, less in terms of a program and more in terms of a posture of justice. What that means is it's not going to be this one-time thing or even the short-term thing. It's going to be an ongoing process where you have committed yourself to dismantling the structural and institutional ways that racism plays itself out to the advantage of white people and to the disadvantage of people of color, specifically African Americans. So no, it's not it. I hope.
Man, you out here, man. You swinging hard, man.
You know. I just hope there's, you know, I know information's part of it, and I know ignorance is going to perpetuate this stuff. And I know someone like Sidney Hyde Smith is blatantly ignorant. And in a sense, you feel sorry for her because she lives in such a small world.
Oh, absolutely.
And she's missing out on the beauty and the joy and the culture and the richness of a more diverse world, which we all are to the extent that we lack those insights and those relationships.
Right. I mean, only truth and love is what matters in the end, as far as our communication. Like, only truth and love is really going to actually, you know, get people's attention. And so we have to have that love in there to recognize that, you know, what they're doing is actually, when people make these types of comments, they're dehumanizing themselves. They're not just dehumanizing us, but they're dehumanizing themselves as well.
That's right.
So, man, here's what I think we should do. I think this has been dope, but I think next week we should talk about actually construct. We should make this a part two. Next week, and talk actually about how we construct a political thought process. Like, we should actually take people into the lab and show them how we think about issues. I think that would be really helpful. And I know this is dangerous. I get it. So, I mean, we can't give y'all all the sauce, but I'm just saying we might be able to show y'all just in one specific area or in a couple of areas how we think about things, because I think that's helpful for people, not just to curse the darkness, but to shine a light. So let's shine the light. And let's talk about how we construct this. Maybe, you know, Black political theology. I'm a big J.D. Otis Roberts fan. So, you know, I like that type of stuff.
Nice,
Prophet of the Black Believers. Two great books that he's written kind of in this vein. So maybe we should do that, Jamar. What you think?
I love it. Yes. Let's, okay, because we get labeled the L word, liberal or whatever. And people sort of dismiss the fact that we've actually thought a lot about this.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to think what you think about us. It's fine. Like, I'm good.
Fine, yeah. But I would actually, like you're saying, it's a matter of discipleship. And so, you know, maybe we can offer a few insights from another perspective that might inform your discipleship.
Y'all gotta stay tuned for that. Part two coming next week.
This episode was brought to you in part by the Areopagus Podcast, two clergy of different traditions, Father Andrew Stephen Damick and Michael Landsman, discuss encounters of historic Christianity with other religious traditions. How do we engage with those who believe differently? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.